Welcome to Historically St. Pete, a weekly conversation where we explore the truths and the myths of the people and events that created the Sunshine City. My name is Rui Frias, and I have the best job in town. I'm the executive director of the St. Petersburg Museum of History. Located on the St. Pete Pier, the Museum of History has been sharing the stories of the Sunshine City for 103 years, and now we're happy to share them with you here on Radio St. Pete. In what seems like a century ago, I started a career in journalism at then the St. Petersburg Times. I was hired the summer after high school to be a copy clerk, basically running around the newsroom doing whatever news editors and reporters wanted or needed. From there, I advanced to sports clerk, pretty much doing the same thing for the sports department, but also creating that beautiful page of 2C, all that agate or statistics. That was one of the most highly read pages of the Times. Eventually, as I progressed in journalism school, I was given a shot at sports reporting, climbing the ladder from high school football to the fishing column, and to eventually as the beat writer for the original version of the Tampa Bay Rowdies. News reporting, and especially sports reporting, has definitely changed since I was at the Times in the 80s. But during that period of the 1970s and 80s, the Tampa Bay area was blessed with some fantastic sports teams, characters, and stories that would easily fill three daily newspapers that we had in this area. So joining us today is someone who I was very fortunate to work with and who lived that time with the St. Petersburg Times, spending over 30 years with the newspaper. Let's welcome reporter, editor, best-selling author, and fantastic rock musician, Dave Scheiber.
Wow, thank you for that introduction, Rui. And it's great to be together. Great to be here at Radio St. Pete.
Absolutely. So I've got all kinds of questions. I know you've got a million stories that, you know, would fill more than the allotted time we have here.
Remember. We'll
yeah,
see.
Okay. So let's start off, like, when you arrived at the Times, what was your first assignment? Did you go into sports first right away?
Yeah, so I was working in a part-time job that was really full-time. Dream job coming out of college at the Washington Post, which was my hometown paper. I'm from the Washington, D.C. area. I had actually tried to take the music track right out of college and joined a country band in Philadelphia. And we tried to make it big and hit Nashville. It didn't work out. So I moved back home, had to get a job. Luckily, I ended up started volunteering for a paper called the Montgomery Sentinel. That led me to the Post as part of their high school team. And I was a copy kid. This was post-Watergate. So all the big figures from Watergate were walking the newsroom. And it was a dream scenario. Ben Bradley, Woodward, and Bernstein.
Wow.
And it was I was in awe and decided this is the career for me. Came down here for a part-time job, hired over the phone to be the part-time prep editor, meaning the high school sports editor, and that was the beginning of it all.
Oh, my gosh. So, I mean, so what year was that you arrived?
I came down in September of 78, and basically the week before had been hired over the phone by Steve Nolgren, who was our old boss, and because Hubert Mizell was such a powerful figure, akin to Tom McEwen on the Tampa Tribune side, Hubert had gone to the college with George Solomon, the sports editor at the Washington Post, and on that word they said, okay, we'll give Scheiber a try. And basically a week later I was driving my orange Cutlass Supreme with the white vinyl top down I-95 and started a new life down here.
That's fantastic. I mean, when you got here, I mean, obviously the whole Tampa Bay area, especially St. Pete, was a much different place than it is today, and there's been so many franchises that have been born, some still live, some have died here, and I'm going to rattle off a bunch of them in a minute, you know, if I want you to touch on. But tell us, like, so when you arrived in the late 70s, what was the sports scene like here?
Well, the Bucks were dominant. College football, University of Florida particularly, but University of Miami, Florida State hadn't yet become the great power under Bowden, but Florida ruled the Gators. The Bucks had started in 76, but then there were the Rowdies, and the Rowdies were born in 75. And amazingly, the soccer scene was so vibrant, as you know. The Rowdies were averaging 30,000 a game, outdrawing the Bucks, who were hapless at that point. I came in, they had just started winning a little bit. The Rowdies, however, as you know, had won the 75 championship, and they were such a big deal. So I would say it was a combination of college football, and then the Bucks were huge, and then the Rowdies were this incredible, magical outfit people loved.
And even before or other than these major league franchises, right? Even the rest of the sports scene. I just remember the newspaper being filled with stories of, you know, the parimutuel stuff from Highlight to, you know, the dog track at Derby Lane in Tampa, and even professional wrestling.
Yeah.
I mean, the Bayfront Center. Oh, my God. Yeah, the American dream, of course, right? I mean, it seemed like the sports page was like – or the sports section was like 30 pages.
It was really a glory year's time. And you and I were there when the Times sports section was awarded the number one sports section in the United States for the large category.
Mm-hmm.
And we all got T-shirts, so I still have mine. It's faded, but I still have it. And, you know, it was an amazing time to be in sports. There was so much talent in the St. Pete Times sports staff. The columnist, the original Bucks football writer, Ron Martz, who had to cover the 0-26 start of that team. Mike Tierney, who we both knew and worked alongside of. Great columnist. Hubert Mizell was nationally renowned. Mm-hmm. And anywhere you turned, there was great writing, but the design and the people who were putting that paper out, the Times really led the pack in this state with color reproduction, which was fairly new at that time.
Absolutely. And I remember, I mean, when I was a copy clerk, one of my jobs was, you know, racing as fast as I could. This tells you how old I am, right? To pick up film at high school football games and race them back to the Times so they can actually process the film and get photos ready.
Gave me a memory too, because we both, I'm sure, I know I had the experience when you're covering a high school game, you took your own play-by-play, you scrawled it out, and then you would have to strategize as where's the nearest payphone, and usually it'd be at a 7-Eleven, and we'd run over to the nearest payphone, put a quarter in, this is really dating us, and call, and you'd have handwritten out your story, and then you would dictate it, somebody would take dictation, and that's how it got in the paper the next day.
That's exactly how it worked with prep sports, especially football on Friday night. It was a madhouse in the newsroom on a Friday night.
Right.
All right, so I'm going to rattle off some stuff here, and I want you to tell me basically, or tell our listeners, like the first thing that pops in your head, right?
Sure.
In the sports scene in those years, spring training.
Spring training, unbelievable. It was like a toy shop for sports fans. Al Lang Stadium, any given day, you would have the Cardinals, great stars from the 70s and 80s, or the Mets hosting any number of great teams. And think of all the Hall of Famers who came through Al Lang Stadium back then.
It's fantastic.
We would do, and maybe you were part of this, the lunch train, this would never be allowed years later, but we'd take a lunch break and go down to catch a few innings of a game and go back and finish working. It was
and it's funny you say that, because I mean, after I left the Times, when I was working for the city doing the Festival of States and all those events downtown, I remember when the Cardinals would play afternoon games, so you know, you'd take lunch and take an extended lunch break, you'd sit in the stands hoping that your boss wouldn't see you. Then you see your boss like four rows below
you. That's exactly right. We're all in it together.
Yeah, yeah. So spring training was a magical time.
Magical time.
All right, Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Well, 0-26, and it was a terrible beginning. I was the third beat writer on the Bucks franchise. It was Ron Martz was number one, Mike Tierney number two. I came in 1982-83, and they were still losing a lot. John McKay was the head coach, very acerbic, very funny, but with a dry, cutting humor.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was people were a little bit scared of him in the press conferences, because for any number of reasons, he might lash out at you if you ask the wrong kind of question. But it was a great, great team to be on. We would all work in something called the Blue Room, and we're all crowded in this little room at the Hall of Fame Inn to write our stories, and we were friends with our fellow beat writers, but we're always trying to scoop people, so it was an incredible.
So I don't know, and I've read this quote in numerous places, and knowing, I didn't know John McKay, but knowing him as a media person, I believe it, when he was asked what he thought about his team's execution. He said he was all for it.
Yes, that was a typical McKay line. It was any number of times he'd come up with these witticisms that he was known for before even coming to the Bucks. So when I started in the covering the franchise in 83, was the first full season, they started 0-9, so it was a return to their losing ways, and one miserable game after the next, and they always invented new ways. That was when Doug Williams had left the team in a dispute with the owner, a contract dispute with Hugh Culverhouse. The franchise never really recovered after that.
Okay.
Until Tony Dungy came along.
That's right. Yeah. It was a long period there. Yeah. Tampa Bay Bandits.
that was a really fun
now,
time.
So now, take in mind, a lot of people may not know who they even are.
Okay, let's set the scene. So in 82, the NFL ruled, but along came some creative minds, marketing minds, John Bassett in this area, and the league, it was a spring league that was to complement the NFL. Eventually, it burned out because of legal problems that dealt with expansion and different issues that came along. But they played off the Rowdies' marketing mystique and magic. It was very fan-friendly. The co-owners were Burt Reynolds and Lonnie Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first game, a big limo shows up with Burt and Lonnie and Jerry Reed, the guy who wrote and sang,
right.
The Bandit. And they all pile out, and that was a short-lived time. It should have lasted longer. And there were some great players, a lot of great NFL players.
But wasn't that part of the problem, though? I mean, they at one point, I think the owners, I mean, they started drafting or started signing all these major
stars. Yeah. Jim Kelly, Herschel Walker, and people who ended up, Gary Anderson, who ended up in the NFL. But the NFL did not take kindly to what became a very competitive league. And it was a very popular league, but it flamed out. In 84, I think, 85, one of those years. It was short-lived, but it was also a really cool time.
Okay. Tampa Bay Thrillers.
You know, I didn't get to cover the Thrillers too much. Bill Ward, I think, was our Thrillers.
He was, yeah.
Writer.
Yeah.
I think Darryl Dawkins might have smashed a backboard back in the day.
He did, I think, yeah.
That was Bayfront Center, right?
Right.
Bayfront Center was an amazing place because that was also where the Rowdies played their indoor games and won an indoor championship in 1980 there. Great concerts, too.
Yeah, absolutely great concerts there. All right, so you've mentioned the Rowdies a couple times. Let's talk about the Rowdies. So the original or the first version of the Tampa Bay Rowdies.
The real Rowdies. Okay. Well, sorry. I just only because that's the Rowdies I know.
Right.
I was there. To me, that's why I say that.
So tell me some stories.
Well, that was a time where players were so happy to be here. These were players who were either up and coming overseas or maybe had achieved a certain level of stardom, maybe were getting on the, I don't know if downside of their careers in some cases, but they found renewed life here. They were almost like rock stars, a lot of these players. And Rowdy's games were wild and fun with Crazy George, who the guy, the mascot, and the San Diego Chicken would come out. There was always a fun factor at these games. These were great players, great games to watch. One of the things I know we've talked about was the access to players. So you'd go on the road and you might hang out with the players, and there was no corporate edict that you know there had to be a separation. Mm-hmm. You had to be professional. You weren't going to do anything that didn't allow you to do your job professionally. But you got to know them. And I remember this one time we were on a road trip up in Buffalo or Rochester. It was the Rochester Lancers. Or
yes,
something.
Yeah. Lancers. Yeah.
And we're killing some time the day before the game, and it was Neil Roberts and Steve Wegerle, and maybe Mike Connell, maybe the old Tampa Times Pete Writer Dick Mudrie. We all went to the movies. It was a first showing of Urban Cowboy. So and then that came, and those guys were from South Africa, Roberts and
Wegerle,
and Connell, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, and Connell.
So
yeah.
They decided to, I think Roberts dubbed himself the Durban Cowboy, and so that became a name that stuck. But you would just do fun things, and you know, it was an interesting, it was a great time.
Do you think that the teams, you know, the Bandits, Rowdies, Buccaneers, all those folks, obviously, our population base was nothing compared to what it is today. They competed for seats in the stands, obviously, these franchises. But it seemed like back then that people were going to all of these games. Because I remember even going to a Thrillers game, and I was surprised when they left. Bill Musselman, I think, was their
coach. Yeah.
They would pack the Bayfront Center, right?
Yeah.
And I think the folks then were buying season tickets or at least attending these games that for multiple franchises.
I think you're right about that. I think that there was a big crossover, even baseball, the spring training as it was. The community supported the teams here. And there was just intense interest in all of them. And we didn't mention, but the Rowdies did draw over 50,000, I think, on two occasions at the old Tampa Stadium unheard of.
Right, right. I think one of them was like San Diego Soccer's 4th of July or something, and like 52,000 people in the stands. Yeah,
crazy.
It was, that was crazy for soccer in this country at the time. And you're right about the player accessibility. I mean, and I don't think it was just with the Rowdies. I think it's some of the other franchises, too.
It was that the Bucks as well. You could
you got to know them. Right.
There was a, let me throw this story out. So Steve Young, you know, Hall of Fame quarterback, one of the greats of all time. He was a backup quarterback in 85. He had come from the USFL, LA Express, and he was backing up maybe Steve DeBerg. And we would be writing our little stories in the blue room at the Hall of Fame Inn, and Steve would pop in, this great future quarterback, and he'd say, "Hey, have you heard anything about my situation? Lehman Bennett say I might have a chance to be starting?" You know, and just that would never happen years later.
Oh,
and
then he'd
go to lunch with us at La Quinta, or JoJo's at La Quinta across the street. there'd be just things that you could do back then that would never happen in terms of access to players.
So moving away from the professional sports a little bit, and not that these aren't professionals, but like I mentioned earlier, that even like paramutuals, the highlight guys, the dog races, the horse races, all got lots of coverage in the newspapers then. But preps were huge.
Oh,
prep coverage was huge. So high school football, of course, was the king, but even all the other sports would fill pages in everybody's daily newspaper at that time. So, I mean, how important do you think that is? I mean, what are your thoughts of like the lack of prep coverage now?
Well, you and I were there at a time when prep coverage was immensely important, and the space allotted to it was great. You'll remember we used to have staff artists who would do these huge illustrations of high school matchups that would be taking place on Friday between Gibbs and Pinellas Park or whatever. And it was a different era. Some of the great stories were human interest stories coming out of the high school beat. There was never any shortage. And I just think that papers have shrunk so much that there just isn't the space. I don't know if that started happening. I had left sports at the Times in 87 to go into the Floridian section and start the weekend magazine section, and then became a feature writer in Floridian. So I lost track a little bit of what was going on with the prep beat, but I think it just started to shrink as newspapers began to shrink in space.
Which is too bad for these kids, actually, because you would see with even back when I was coaching high school soccer, and they'd pick up the paper and they'd see their name or their picture in the paper. It was like they were playing for the Rowdies.
Right. and football, basketball, all huge.
Absolutely. All right. So as you mentioned, I mean, you didn't, your whole career wasn't in sports. You went on to become a feature editor and writer at the Times. But sticking in sports, what was your worst interview?
Okay. Let me think real quick. I think Ted Turner, I think he was enjoying himself on his cruise. He come in a yacht. I was sent down to interview Ted Turner. And it was complete zero of an interview. I'm trying to think.
Is this before or after he moved the bounty?
Before. Okay. It was before. And gosh, I'm trying to think in terms of football. I've had more than a few. You know, it was always tough in spring training because Frank Robinson, for instance, renowned, great figure in baseball history, the late Frank Robinson. And he could not have been less interested in doing an interview with a young kid who was trying to do a job and made me wait. Tom Seaver as well made me wait like 3 hours. Just he wanted to do his post game rep. He knew I had come a long way down to do the interview in Sarasota, and just gave it as little as needed. And that happens, you know.
Sure.
It wasn't recognizable to him. So.
So, then, what was your best interview? Would you say?
Okay, let me think. There's a lot. So let me say that Peyton Manning was a great interview. I had done a story in 2004 when I returned to sports. Actually, I had a return to sports after my time in features. So I started my career at the Times in 78 to 87, then went over to features to start the Weekend Magazine, did that for 10 years, then became a feature writer for 6 or 7 years, went back to sports. And one of my first stories was Cooper Manning, the unknown Manning brother, who would have
except
been
for now, who's on TV all over the place.
Time, but he had a back was a back condition, spinal stenosis, so he never progressed beyond college and would have been famous. So I interviewed all three Mannings, and Peyton was hard to get to, but when I finally got him on the phone, just was great. And I think obviously he wanted to do something to support his brother, but was a joy to talk to, and That one comes to mind.
That's always good to hear. It's good to hear when those guys at that level.
Yeah, are, didn't have to.
Right, give me the
time,
right, right.
It gave me lots of time.
So, and on you've written thousands, right? But what is one of your most memorable stories that you wrote?
I would say 2006. Was it six? It might have been seven, sorry. But I was sent to Hawaii. And I think this might still rank number one. It was to cover the Kids and Cubs, St. Pete's own Kids and
oh
Cubs.
Oh, my God.
But they were playing. But get this. So they had arranged to play a softball game in the name of peace and reconciliation with the counterparts of the Kids and Cubs from Japan.
Okay.
And they were a softball team from Japan called the Over the Rainbows. And I'm not exactly sure where they, you know, obviously from the movie. But,
right.
So we, the editor at the Times, I think it was Steve Buckley, was for it. Pat Farnan, former Metro editor, got behind this story, said, we got to do this story. So I actually went as a, maybe for Metro almost, because it was bigger. It was it was going to be a 1A story, whatever. But it was an amazing story where these guys who fought each other, tried to kill each other in World War II, all of them were veterans of the Pacific Theater.
That makes sense now. And, yeah, absolutely.
And that was the reason for the game. And there was tears, the hugs, and the Kids and Cubs were pretty tough to beat, actually. That was the
They're
least
always
important
tough
thing
to
about
beat.
The game. The game was the least important thing, but the emotion and the bonding was an amazing thing to see and write about. And ran on 1A, and it was a very gratifying.
That is a fantastic story. I mean, they've been a part of our sports legacy for 100 years
going
here,
back to
right?
Babe Ruth, but,
yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, winding this down, what are your thoughts on sports coverage today? I mean, when you look at, you know, what we went through, and obviously you were in it a million years more than I was, but it's I get frustrated sometimes, right? So what are your thoughts on sports coverage?
I have all the respect in the world for the writers who are at the Tampa Bay Times, Romano, great columnist, Topkin, Stratt. I don't want to leave anybody out, but those were guys I knew and worked alongside and think they do a phenomenal job. I think it's just a manpower thing and a space issue. Newspapers have shrunk. A lot of them have been struggling since 08, 09, when the market crashed. And I think that there's just less that can be done with fewer people and more story sharing, wire stories. Travel isn't what it used to be. We used to, remember I was mentioning, I would go to rowdy games that were just regular season games to California or Canada.
Right.
That stuff would be unheard of. There's just not the manpower or the space to do what we used to do. But I have great respect for all the people who are still out there doing it.
Even in the last few years when I was in the classroom, I'd get the paper delivered right to the school, and I was trying to get the kids to read the paper, and they'd look at me like I was speaking a foreign language, and they would, you know, pull out their phones and want to start scrolling and reading it on their phones. I'm like, no, pick up the paper.
Well,
you know,
I have to say this one thing, Rui. You taught three of my kids, and they loved you as a professor, teacher. They just loved your class and thought you did a great job. So thank you for that.
Well, this is my last question, actually. So how the heck did you do this whole life that you've had and raise what, six kids?
Six kids. Yeah, six.
You're talking about me being busy. You were a busy guy.
Five daughters and a son.
Five daughters.
Yeah, it's been a busy life.
It takes me 3 days to recover from babysitting our grandson one day a week. So,
well, it's just been, you know, and then there's the band. We have the band and the family.
Oh, yeah. Tell us a little bit about the band
here. The band's Ocean Road. We've been in different bands. There was the Fabulous Nosecaps that involved Klinkenberg, Mike Foley, Roy
Clark. All the times, guys.
Greg Huffman. And we had this band for many years at the Times that was just great. We were a glorified garage band, but we had a following. So that was a great time. Then we did a spinoff. Mike Foley and I and Greg Huffman started Stalled on the Tracks, which was a country band catching the country wave going on early on in the 90s. We did that for about 6-7 years, and I started Ocean Road in early 2000s. We just do covers of popular songs from the 70s to the present. I run it. My wife has been in it for many years, but she's pulling back. She's insisting she's retired. Two of my daughters still in it. One sings, one drums, and we have a lot of good players, and we play. And we got to play the benefit for St. Pete Museum of History.
You did, and tell you what, you're way more than a glorified garage band. You guys are really
good. Thank you.
So,
I would say the Nosecaps were that. We try to be good, and we do play a lot of private parties in the yacht club, and we're getting younger with our repertoire because the audience is getting younger. So
if you need a band out there, contact Dave.
Absolutely.
They're fantastic to listen and to dance to, right?
Thank you.
So Dave, thank you so much for joining us today on Historically St. Pete and sharing this unique piece of history with us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. The museum appreciates everything you guys have done, especially the newspaper. We use the Times Archives to do a tremendous amount of our research, so we appreciate all that work. I invite everyone to tune in weekly to RadioSt.Pete.com for Historically St. Pete and to stop by the Museum of History on your next visit to the pier and explore the rich and unique history of the Sunshine City. You can visit HistorySt.Pete.org for more details on our exhibits and events. Thanks for listening and join us next week on Historically St. Pete.